This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The U.S. Marine Corps was the last all-white branch of the military. In 1941, it was ordered to begin recruiting and enlisting African Americans. Why did these men enlist, and what was it like to be among the Corps' first black members? Those are a couple of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Our guest is historian Melton McLaurin. He is the author of The Marines of Montford Point, America's First Black Marines. Melton McLaurin is a professor emeritus of history at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. While he was serving as the school's associate vice chancellor for academic affairs, he had a conversation with a retired Marine, Dr. Clarence Willie. Willie asked McLaurin if he was aware of the story of the Montford Point Marines. "Vaguely aware," said McLaurin, and that was the beginning of this documentary project. Veterans of Montford Point were interviewed on film. The book, The Marines of Montford Point, contains excerpts of those interviews, and they allow us to become acquainted with this part of our history. They allow us to become acquainted with this part of our history through the voices of some remarkable men. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good, anywhere in the continental U.S. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. 222-WILL. Melton McLaurin is the author of 8 books, including the award-winning Separate Pasts, Growing Up White in the Segregated South. The book, The Marines of Montford Point, America's First Black Marines, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor McLaurin, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's my pleasure.
The first thing I want to ask you about is about Dr. Clarence Willie. Tell us about him.
Well, Clarence Willie and I were serving on a United Way board. Dr. Willie was an educator. He was an assistant superintendent of a county school system in the region here in North Carolina. More importantly, he was a lieutenant colonel retired from the United States Marine Corps and an African-American. And Dr. Willie had known some of the original Montford Pointers when he was a young officer stationed at Camp Lejeune. And we became friends as a result of our work with United Way, and then went on to continue to work on the Montford Point Project from 1999 until the present.
Yeah. Remarkable story. You know, when we think of African-American soldiers who were America's first black soldiers, we're likely to think of the Tuskegee Airmen or the Buffalo Soldiers or the soldiers who served in the Union Army during the Civil War. Why has this story, the story of the Montford Point Marines, been slow to emerge?
Well, I think there's several reasons for that, and I've given this a lot of thought because I get this question frequently. I think maybe the major reason is that, unfortunately, African Americans are not part of the mythology and especially the iconography of the Second World War. That's true if you think about movies all the way from The Sands of Iwo Jima with John Wayne up to Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers, and Eastwood does give about a two-second nod of the head to the Montford Point Marines. But African-Americans are just not there, by and large, although they certainly did participate in the Second World War. There are other reasons, too. I think the Buffalo Soldiers, for example, they were a combat outfit. They were cavalry, and the cavalry has this dashing imagery. And also the Tuskegee Airmen, they were officers, and they were airmen. And I think everything from all the Strategic Air Command films or the Second World War films on airmen to Top Gun, to airmen are glamorous, you know. these men were performing primarily service duties. They had no officers. All their officers were white. There are a variety of reasons why they got very little publicity.
Yeah. They were at Iwo Jima, some of the Monford Pointers, and one of the people, one of the men that you have profiled in the book, in this oral history, says at Iwo Jima, the cameramen turned away from the black soldiers.
That was his recollection. Now, I'd have to say that, all of these are interviews. We interviewed 60-some men, and this is their understanding of what happened. But that is a statement that he made. And, of course, we know that there were approximately 900 African-Americans on Iwo Jima. And I'll bet very few Americans understand that African-American Marines were a part of that invasion force.
Yeah, I had no awareness of it at all. So,
and that's fairly typical.
Yeah. Monford Point was constructed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Why Camp Lejeune?
Because they didn't want to send the Marines, the African-Americans, to Parris Island in South Carolina. Camp Lejeune was a new base. It was in the American South. It was relatively isolated. And I think those are the reasons. But basically, it's that the Marine Corps did really what the other services were doing, both the Army and the Navy, and that is segregating those African-Americans they had been forced to accept.
Hmm. You wonder, though, you know, could they have built this camp somewhere that it would have been easier for the African-American Marines to live?
Well, if you're thinking about it in terms of segregation,
mm-hmm.
You have to remember that segregation was an American policy. It was federal policy. The idea that segregation existed only in the South is, of course, basically nonsense. While there were major differences between the South and the rest of the country, I think it's really important to understand that segregation was the policy of the United States. It was not something that just happened in the American South. The federal civil service was segregated. The federal military branches were segregated. Washington was a segregated town. The doctrine of separate but equal was the accepted federal law of the land, and that's the society in which these men were recruited and in which they enlisted, so that the federal government and the Marine Corps, to put it bluntly, were not terribly concerned about the sensibilities of African-American recruits.
Hmm. They did. These Marines did contribute, though, to the dismantling of legal segregation eventually. Talk with us about that, this accomplishment.
Well, they were a part of a process that led to the dismantling. And one of the things that they wanted to do, and of course that African-American soldiers and African-American sailors wanted to do in the Second World War, was to prove that they could perform as well under any conditions, battlefield conditions or whatever, as their white counterparts. And this in itself helped to begin to break down segregation. Also, I think their perceptions, or the perceptions of the American public, did change in part because of the performance of these men. And you have to remember that these men not only were the first African-American Marines and trained at a separate facility, they are also the same men, the men who trained at Monford Point, are the individuals who actually integrated the Marine Corps when the Marine Corps did integrate its units, its platoons, its companies, and the line companies that were actually fighting infantry companies during the Korean War. It was men trained at Monford Point who integrated these units. So they have two major claims. One, they are the first African-American Marines, and two, they are the African-American Marines who actually integrate the units of the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. The order, to the Marines to begin recruiting and enlisting African-Americans was issued in 1941 by Franklin Roosevelt. What led him to issue that order?
Well, this was an order that did more than, of course, get the Marine Corps to accept African-Americans. It created the Fair Employment Practices Commission, and it was forced upon Roosevelt, literally. A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Sleeping Car Porters Union in the United States, and other civil rights leaders had threatened Roosevelt with a march on Washington in the summer of 1941 unless Roosevelt issued an order that made it very clear that African Americans would not be closed out of the economic opportunities that war preparations were sure to bring. And under extreme pressure from Randolph and others, who threatened to put 100,000 marchers into the streets of Washington, Roosevelt finally signed the executive order that said that the federal government and military contractors and civilian contractors working for the federal government could not refuse to employ African Americans. It allowed continued segregation in that employment, but it at least stopped both the federal government and contractors from absolutely refusing to accept African Americans. And Roosevelt was very reluctant to do that because of the power of Southern congressmen within the Congress, where he feared for domestic legislation if he angered many of these powerful Southern congressmen.
Hmm. Something you point out in the introduction that I'd like you to talk about here, because it's something I think we should be aware of, is you point out that by their service in the Spanish-American War and the Philippine Insurrection, black troops helped the U.S. conquer territories populated by darker-skinned peoples. And you say those actions, ironically, fanned the flames of white supremacy at home. Would you offer us first a little background on the Philippine Insurrection and then talk about that rising tide of white supremacy in the U.S. in the early 20th century?
Well, I think the Philippine Insurrection best illustrates this. There was an independence movement in the Philippines, and when we went into the Philippines, we went in, of course, in the Spanish-American War, took over the Philippines from Spain. And instead of allowing the Filipinos independence, we made the Philippines part of the American Empire. And those Filipinos who wanted an independent country, led by a man named Aguinaldo, engaged in a three-year guerrilla war campaign against the United States. It's probably one of the least known wars which the United States government fought. And for good reason. I mean, I don't think it's something, quite frankly, that we want to play up in our history books. But the revolution was ultimately crushed, and the Philippines became a part of the United States. And much of the expansionism that was associated with the Spanish-American War into Cuba, into the Philippines, other areas of the Caribbean, Hawaii, for example, was fueled by the concept of the white man's burden, that the idea that the civilized white societies of Europe primarily, but the doctrine was also employed by Americans, should take the virtues and advances of civilization to the darker-skinned, uncivilized people of the world.
Mm. So 40 years later, the Philippine Insurrection, 1899 to 1901, 40 years later, 1941, how is the order received by the Marine Corps?
The Marine Corps fought every effort to force it to recruit or enlist African Americans. My favorite quote, which I use in the book, the Commandant of the Marine Corps at that time said that if he had a choice between 250,000 black troops and 5,000 white troops, he'd rather have the 5,000 white troops. I think that pretty much says it all about the attitude of the Marine Corps toward accepting African Americans.
So they kind of dragged their feet there for a while. In 1942, they begin accepting Marines at Montford Point, correct?
That's correct. They were under direct orders to begin recruiting and enlisting African Americans, and so they had no choice except to comply with that order from the President of the United States.
Hmm. Now, the African Americans who enlisted, what kind of backgrounds did they come from?
It's really interesting. They were, on average, slightly older and slightly better educated than their white counterparts. They came from every background you can think of, really. They came from pretty much east of the Mississippi River. They came from small farms and rural communities in the South and the North. They came from large cities. They were people who worked on tenant farms and artisans and craftsmen and day laborers, but they were also teachers and people with some medical backgrounds, just a whole variety of individuals who came into the Corps.
Yeah. One of the veterans of Montford Point is a former mayor of New York City.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. David Dinkins was a Montford Point Marine. He came in late. He came in 1945,
right,
but he did go through his training at Montford Point and served for a brief period after the war in the Marine Corps as a part of a segregated unit that had been organized at Montford Point.
Yeah. It wasn't easy for him to enlist. He had to keep trying.
He had to keep trying because he was told when he attempted to enlist that his blood pressure was too high. And he attempted to enlist at several different recruiting stations, always told that his blood pressure was too high, but was so persistent that they finally took the word of a private doctor that his blood pressure was okay, and so Dinkins got in.
Why did he want to join the Marines?
Well, I think Dinkins put it very well. He felt that the Marine Corps offered the best combat training that you could possibly get, and he wanted to be as prepared as possible. If he were going to have to go into combat, he wanted to be able to come out.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Melton McLaurin, author of The Marines of Montford Point, America's First Black Marines. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. We look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener waiting to talk with you, Melton McLaurin, on line four. A listener in Chicago. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
By the time the Korean War came around, were there still segregated black units in the Marine Corps, or were they fully integrated?
When the war broke out, there were still segregated units. As a matter of fact, the Marine Corps was very slow to implement an order that Harry Truman issued in 1948, requiring all units of the military forces in the federal government to desegregate. He also issued a companion order requiring the civil services to desegregate. But there were still segregated Marine Corps units when the war broke out. Now, the Korean War is what caused the Marine Corps to rapidly desegregate. Once it made the decision to desegregate, I talked with men who shipped out of California in segregated black units and got off the boat in Korea and went directly into integrated platoons and companies.
Now, how was this viewed by the white Marines who had served in World War II and after in segregated units? How did they handle this?
How did the white Marines handle it?
Yeah.
Well, from what I understand from most of the African-American Marines, and you have to remember that they were very small in number. The Marine Corps kept only about 1,300 black Marines after the Second World War. In Korea, things were so tough. I mean, people were trying to survive so that color on the battlefield didn't become a major issue. It was just a question of survival. And when you talk to these men, particularly the men who went through things like the landing at Incheon.
And the Chosun Reservoir.
And the Chosun Reservoir especially, which was just a brutal, brutal, brutal campaign.
I understand that they actually wrote off the 1st Marine Division at one point, said we've lost it.
Yep, and that's where you had that famous order about, you know, we're not retreating, we're sort of advancing to the rear, and which was actually true in many ways, but it was brutal. It was bitterly cold, you know, minus 30, minus 40 degrees, and these men were not worried about the color of somebody's skin next to them.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, it's always when you hear about the Marine Corps, you always hear about flags of our fathers on Iwo Jima and things like that. And I'm not putting that down, but I'm just saying very few people realize what these men went through in places like Korea at the Chosun Reservoir, where they actually almost wrote off the 1st Marine Division. They said, it's almost gone. We can't get it back.
Yeah, we have in the documentary some extraordinarily brutal film from archives that shows what these men went through.
It'd be a pity if all the things thought about Korea was just MASH.
Korea in many ways is the forgotten war, but I think what's important about Korea as far as this story is concerned is that Korea is where the Marine Corps became an integrated service.
Now, during the World War II, though, didn't they suggest that most blacks join the Army? I mean, if you want to try and get into the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Coast Guard, and of course the Air Force didn't, you could forget about that in the beginning.
Well, the Marine Corps made it very clear that they would have preferred that all African-American service personnel be in the Army.
They would say, why don't you go join the Army?
They did say that.
Yeah.
It's a commandant of the Corps actually issued a statement that if African-Americans wanted to serve their country, they had ample opportunity to do so in the Army.
Yeah, and then, of course, the Army hated it, too. They didn't. They would just ship them out in whole units, and that would... That was problems of its own right there.
Well, you had segregated units in the Army, and you had always had segregated units in the Army. The Army had had black units since the Civil War with the creation of the United States Colored Troops in 1862, and segregation had been maintained as the pattern in the American Army from 1862 forward, which is another example of what I was talking about earlier, of a national policy of segregation.
When did African Americans begin to become officers?
That's a very interesting question. You had officers, and I can't speak to when the first African Americans became officers in the Army and Navy, but it would have been much, much earlier. In the Marine Corps, the first person to become an officer was 1947. His name was Frederick Branch. He died rather recently. But when he was made a second lieutenant, he was immediately put on reserve status and not retained at active duty status.
I want to thank the listener from Chicago for his call this afternoon, and I want to take another call now. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon, Dr. McLaurin. Would you be so kind as to revisit the Philippine invasion for me? What we do know is that in 1902 and 1903, there was virtual genocide, and Mark Twain absolutely accused the president of that, and we do know that Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt simply would not be in the same room together afterwards. And what do you know about Mark Twain's anti-imperialist league? Thank you for taking my call.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm not a military historian. I am a historian of the American South and race relations, and that's the way I came to this topic. But I do know a little bit about the Philippine insurrection and had to read a little bit. And, of course, I know about Twain and Twain's opposition and the opposition of many Americans to our campaign in the Philippines to stop the independence movement in the Philippines. And Mark Twain was perhaps the leading American intellectual in opposing this war and wrote some of the most devastating critiques of the American efforts to quash the insurrection in the Philippines. And it was not a pretty war. It was a very, very brutal war. I'm not sure that this is a true story, but I have read that the United States Army changed its standards issue sidearm from a .38 to a .45 caliber in the Philippine insurrection because the Philippine insurrectionaries would tie tourniquets around the waist and use machetes in attacking American troops, and it was hard to put them down with a .38, so they changed to a .45, which made, of course, a much bigger hole in the body cavity. I don't know if that's absolutely true or not, but I have read that.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Melton McLaurin, author of The Marines of Montford Point, America's First Black Marines. Other telephone calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First African-American officer in the Marine Corps, 1947. So who trained the black recruits at Montford Point? Who were their officers?
The officers were all white, and that continued until the integration of the Corps. The drill instructors, however, after late 1943, were African American. The original drill instructors were whites in the Marine Corps, and I think it's amusing that the Marine Corps chose individuals that they deemed experienced with, quote, colored peoples. And these were people who had served in the Philippines or who had served in Cuba or had served in some of the parts of the American Empire, as it were. And they were put in drill sergeant positions, drill instructor positions. But they were gradually phased out, and African Americans were trained to become drill instructors.
What were the relationships like between the enlisted men and their officers?
They varied. Some of the officers were considered by the African-American troops to be good officers, and some of them were clearly very prejudiced, especially those who were from the Deep South and did not mind showing that prejudice. Some of them retained those attitudes, but some of them changed their attitudes as a result of the performance of the black recruits there at Montford Point.
How did the enlisted men, the Marines of Montford Point, how did they deal with all the indignities that they endured?
I think they dealt with it by developing a very strong sense of camaraderie among themselves, among the units that were formed there, whether they were ammunition companies or depot companies. And there were also two combat units that were formed there during the war. They were called defense battalions, the 51st and 52nd defense battalions. They all seemed to have a real sense of camaraderie. And you also have to remember that this kind of anti-black feeling was sort of the norm. I mean, the racism that they encountered at Jacksonville, North Carolina, was no different than the racism they had encountered at parts of Mississippi or South Carolina, wherever they came from. Now, for the recruits from the North, having to face segregation proved much more difficult. psychologically. They knew about segregation. They had read or had been told about what things were like in the South, but when they actually came down and experienced it, it was still a shock.
Yeah. Let's talk with some more listeners now. Next listener is in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes. I read a book. It was about black GIs in the Army during World War II, and they all yearned to be combat soldiers to prove that to the American majority race, primarily, they were willing to shed their blood for dignity. And they had to really, really strive not to be just support troops. In fact, my father was in the Navy in the Pacific, and the best he could do was be a steward, even though he wanted to man the 50 caliber machine gun. My question to you, were the Marines, the black Marines, were they in a support unit primarily, or were they allowed to be combat soldiers?
That's a very good question. They were primarily support units, as I just indicated. They were organized into ammunition companies and depot companies, and those are the guys who went in on Iwo and also Peleliu and Saipan and Okinawa in the Pacific. There were two combat units organized, the 51st and 52nd Defense Battalion, but they were never put in combat situations. It was the ammo and depot companies who got involved in combat. But also, all Marines were first and foremost riflemen. They had to be trained as riflemen, and as a couple of the guys say in the film and as they say in the book, you don't start moving ammo till you establish a beachhead, and establishing a beachhead means going in there with a rifle and helping to establish it. So the guys who went in these island campaigns were very much involved in combat. But you're right, they did want to prove their mettle. They did want to show that they could function in combat just as well as white Marines. And the men in the 51st and 52nd Defense Battalions resented the fact that they were not assigned to combat situations and believed that it was because of their skin color that they weren't assigned to combat situations. It's also true that globally, speaking more globally or generally, the black troops after the Civil War were in combat units. There were four regiments. There was the 9th and 10th Cavalry Regiment, the 24th and 25th Infantry Regiments. And up until the First World War, really, they had been combat units. But with the First World War and the establishment of the draft, the black units that were formed as a result of the draft in the Army, over 90% of them were put into service units, which again spoke to the heightened sense of racism that you see in American society early in the 20th century.
Yeah. One other thing, in this book I read, Blood for Dignity, the thing that really outraged the African-American Army people who wanted to be in combat and were held back was when they were in the South, some German POWs were allowed to cavort with the white GIs, sit on the front of the bus, whereby black GIs in uniform were treated as second-class citizens, which created much anger within the black GIs' circumstance.
Yeah, there's a story like that in the book here in the Marines of Montford Point.
Yeah, that's one of the things that the men who saw this, the African-American men who saw this, who experienced this, really were resentful and bitter about, and with good cause. When you were told that Red Cross girls coming out, canteen girls coming out to a train to give donuts and coffee to servicemen are told by a white officer to serve German prisoners before you serve black Marines in the uniform of their country, that's about as blatant a form of racism and discrimination as one can possibly imagine, and I'm sure that many Americans today are absolutely shocked, and some of them may tend not to believe that that was the situation, but that indeed was the situation in the United States, during the period of the Second World War.
Yeah. Also, I believe you tell a story in the book, or someone does, I don't know if it's you or if it's some of the men, that when the order was issued in 1948 by President Truman that the military was to desegregate, that the word was in the Marine Corps among black Marines that black Marines would be relegated to the steward branch of the service.
This was a rumor that swept through the ranks of those blacks who had remained in the Corps after the Second World War.
Yeah.
And there was some basis for it. If you look at the breakdown of where black individuals were assigned after the war, large numbers of them were assigned to the stewards branch. Others were in a training unit there at Montford Point and conducted the training of new black recruits. And there were very few in segregated service companies, ammo and depot companies. But even more significant is the fact that the administration was thinking about 10% of the post-Second World War Corps to be African-American, about 10,000 out of 100,000 men. What the Marine Corps did was to keep approximately 1,300 African-Americans after the Second World War. So just slightly over 1% of the Corps was African-American at the time of the Korean War.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Yeah, is this me?
Yep, that's you.
Okay. Thanks for the show. I just I was in the Marines from the early 90s to the mid-90s. And when I was in, we had, it wasn't a mandatory thing, but we had a recommended reading list for Marines. I was just wondering if your guest, if he knew whether his book was on that list or not currently.
You're absolutely right. The Corps does have that, and they have that list for a number of levels in terms of ranks within the Corps. And to my knowledge, the book is not on that list. I'm sure the University of North Carolina Press would be delighted were it to be placed on that list.
The book is just out, though, too.
Yes,
right?
That's
yeah.
correct.
Yeah.
It's brand new. It's just in the bookstores, as a matter of fact.
Well, I guess what I was thinking was that you spoke earlier of us not wanting to publicize or revisit the negative points of American history when you spoke of the Philippines and things like that, and not that your book is negative in any way, but I think it's important. I guess what I was just saying was I think it's important that a book like yours be on that list potentially so that we don't forget things like that, that that's ever present in our understanding of what the Marine Corps' history is about, so...
Well, I appreciate that. I see this as a very positive work, though, because it is positive, and these men are positive. They did help kill segregation in the United States. They did integrate the Marine Corps. They did turn the United States Marine Corps into one of the most fully and totally integrated institutions in American society. They did make careers in the Marine Corps possible for the next generation. I mean, these are men who achieved enormous results, in my opinion.
I'm going to take another call here in just a second, but how do we see the film?
That the University of North Carolina Wilmington is working on as we speak. I hope that you'll be able to see it on a PBS station near you sometime in the not-too-distant future, but there are a variety of potentialities, and that's not something I'm involved with. I'm not a marketing person or a media person,
mm-hmm.
and the film is the University of North Carolina Wilmington. It's their film, so... we'll see how that goes.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye out for it. Before we run out of time here, I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit about one of these remarkable men, and I guess I would pick Stephen Robinson.
Well, I think you're right. I wish I could tell you about Stephen Robinson, but I really can't. I know about Stephen Robinson, the interview because unfortunately Stephen Robinson is among the deceased. He was interviewed in 2001. This is a project that has been going on for some time. I do know that he has a son and a family. He was a lawyer, and I think he may have been a lawyer in Illinois. I'm not Illinois, Michigan, in the Midwest somewhere. I can't remember. I've got it in the book, but I don't have time to look it up right now. But he practiced law for 50 years, an extremely well-spoken individual, as his education and profession would indicate. But he just had a remarkable knack of coming to, I think, the most important points in the stories he was telling. And his interviews are definitely remarkable.
Yeah. He was one of the men on Iwo Jima.
He was on Iwo Jima, was wounded on Iwo Jima, saw people killed on Iwo Jima. He and some others, there's a gentleman named Ellis Cunningham, for example, who was also in Iwo Jima, who's from South Carolina and is retired in South Carolina, still living. And Mr. Cunningham fought in the Second World War, in the Korean War, and in the Vietnamese War. And there are quite a few guys who stayed in the service who have that record of fighting in all three of those wars.
One other, maybe you would talk with us a little bit about Archibald Mosley. He was from Carbondale,
Illinois. He was from Carbondale, and Archibald Mosley is I did get to know and actually got to know Reverend Mosley and his wife. I went on to Wilberforce University, became a Methodist minister after the war. He was also on Iwo, one of my favorite interviews. And I interviewed him. Dr. Willie interviewed about two-thirds of the individuals, and I interviewed about a third. And Reverend Mosley was one of the individuals I interviewed. Remarkable memory. I had not known that the Montford Point Marines had been sent in to Nagasaki, and he talked about being in Nagasaki. He was also one of the very few people who mentioned his wife and deprogramming, the fact that they had gone through such violent experiences, and he didn't have any help dealing with that, he said, except for his wife helped him come to terms with the experiences that he'd had in the Second World War.
Yeah, he married about a year after he was out of the service.
That's correct.
And he would have these terrible nightmares.
Right.
And his wife would say, "You're still fighting the war."
Yeah. And they are just a wonderful couple.
So we have a minister, a lawyer, people who were career Marine. Are there other, what other kinds of post-service careers did these men embark on?
Just about anything you can think of. Some of them were salespeople. Some of them were laborers in meatpacking plants and steel plants. Some of them were college faculty. Two of them I know were college faculty. One got a PhD and was on the college faculty at Clemson for years. Another taught at a school here in North Carolina. Johnson C. Smith taught history, as a matter of fact. Some others were educators in public school systems, civil service personnel, the post office, various state civil service agencies, just like their white counterparts, just about anything you can think of, they were involved with.
A fascinating story. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon and my thanks to Dr. Clarence Willie. The two of you have done a remarkable job here.
Well, thank you. I hope that people will enjoy the book, and I hope that this book, as well as the documentary, which I very much hope will soon be shown, will bring the story of the men of Montford Point to the larger American public. That was the reason for doing the entire project.
Melton McLaurin, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Melton McLaurin is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He is the author of 8 books, including this book that we talked about this afternoon, The Marines of Montford Point, America's First Black Marines. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press. And let me also mention that there are a couple of websites that you might be interested in, listeners. And one of the websites, the address is quite lengthy, but what we've done here at AM 580 is we've put these two websites on our website so you can link right to them. The first one is actually a place within the website of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, their library. And then the other is www.montfordpointmarines.com. That's the Montford Point Marines Association website. And again, you can link to these two websites at our website, will.uiuc.edu. Just go to the Afternoon Magazine and to today's program, and there you'll be.